Tax Committee to order. Members, today we have Department of Revenue here to give us a presentation on the recently completed tax incidence study. Dr. Wilson, welcome to the committee.
Senator Bach, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm sure I can get this working here. The tax incidence study, this is the 10th edition of it, and so we have quite a history of presentations and things here, but this is a significant effort on the part of the Department of Revenue. There's no other state that does a study like this on a regular basis. If I could just give a little credit to a few of the people in the room who actually did the work on this study, who are over here. George Temple was the lead researcher on the project. And Phil Anthony and Mara Westcott are also here, did a lot of the work. We've actually done a lot of work going back and trying to improve and to add some more information in the study. So if you look at the study, you'll see a bit more information in there than in some past studies as well. The study looks at the base year for the tax incidence study is 2006. Okay, so we do talk a bit. The last study was 2004. So this gives us the chance to look at what happened between 2004 and 2006 historically. And then we do projections out 5 years to 2011 as well. And so we can also look at what the study suggests would happen between 2006 and 2011 under current law. And I want to talk about those results and talk about our attempt to understand why things change the way they do between those years. But I do want to start, particularly for some people who may not be as familiar with the study as others, just by going through some definitions, some things that lead to some confusion, and some explanation of how we put this together.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask a question, just so I get started correctly? So is it true to say everything, generally speaking, everything you're going to tell us is the way now it was in 2006 as compared to 2004? Just so I kind of have a basis of what you're going to be talking about. Maybe if I read the study, it would become apparent, but I haven't.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. Our base year is 2006, so that most results you see in the study are for calendar year 2006.
Okay.
We do the projections through 2011, though, so in some sense you may be more interested in that projection than 2006. I realize that it looks like ancient history when you look at 2006. It just takes us this long to get the data together to do a study. So this most recent data we have complete is 2006.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The study includes both state and local taxes. So it includes about 99% of all the taxes that are collected in the state of Minnesota by state and local governments. Local governments here include school districts, special districts, and so it's an inclusive definition of local. In 2006, $22.1 billion of taxes were collected, and that grows a bit in 2011. On the slide, you'll notice that the burden in 2006, what we actually allocate as the burden of those taxes on Minnesota residents, is $18.5 billion. The difference being portions of the tax that we believe are paid, or burden is borne by either consumers of other states, non-residents who buy products in Minnesota, or by owners of capital who basically are paying some of the tax, bearing some of the burden of the business taxes levied by the state of Minnesota. It's somewhat important to understand our definition of business tax.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Wilson, with the Minnesota burden, have you calculated for like sales tax? Because, I mean, there's a lot of talk this year about sales tax on clothing, and some people say that's largely paid by people out of state or the taxes we already have on rental cars. Do you have them specifically to each type of tax, presumably not clothing because we don't have it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, that's correct. We only have in the study the things that are currently taxed. We have done work on some of the tax expenditures, I guess would be the term for them, because they're not in the tax base. That tax expenditure budget does give information about how much, which we publish every other year, how much would be raised by those, although those are dated estimates at this point. There was a presentation at the House yesterday where they did include some of our work on the distribution of what would happen if you taxed some of those items. So clothing was one of those included on the list over there. So we have provided information on those, but they're not in the study.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, on that point, like with the sales tax or motor vehicle rental car taxes, is that 50% Minnesota, non-Minnesota, or is it 80% Minnesotan, or do you have any clue off the top of your head on something like that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I don't have it off the top of my head. I believe we would assume that most of that is paid by non-residents, although a lot of that is business, is really rentals that Minnesota businesses would pay for as well. Our definition of business tax should be understood as an economic definition. It's not a legal definition. Lawyers would obviously define what's a business tax and an individual tax differently. We're not defining it based upon who is legally required to collect the tax. The cigarette tax, for example, is considered to be an individual tax by us because we believe it's all passed on basically to consumers in higher prices. So that even though it's collected by business, we don't consider it a business tax. In our definitions, we refer to business tax. It's a different kind of definition. Business taxes in the study include corporate income tax, taxes on business property, including rental property, and by that I mean apartments and other rental property. The property taxes on those are included in the business tax category, and also consumption taxes on products or services that are purchased for business use. So the insurance premiums tax, to the extent that that's on business insurance, we would assume that that's a business tax. To the extent that it's on homeowner insurance, we'd assume it's an individual tax. But a lot of the sales tax, for example, is paid by businesses on business purchases, so that part of the sales tax is defined as part of the business taxes. The individual income tax is considered to be an individual tax. I know in some definitions of business taxes, the tax is paid by S-corps and partnerships, as well as sole proprietors and farmers, might be considered business taxes instead. Again, for our purposes, for incidents, I think it makes sense to define that the burden is falling on the person who files the income tax return. But just be aware, business taxes can be defined in different ways, and just want to be a little aware of how we define it in the study. As I say, the study includes over 99% of the taxes collected. This is just a list that points out the business taxes. I think it's important sometimes to realize that the largest tax on business in the state of Minnesota is the property tax. 42% of what we consider business taxes in the study are property taxes. 32% of them are sales taxes paid by businesses on purchase of their inputs. And sales tax here includes motor vehicle sales tax. The corporate franchise tax is 16% of the business tax. And again, motor fuels tax, if it's fuels purchased by business, or mortgage and deed taxes on business property, all these are considered to be business taxes in the way we put the model, the study together.
Senator Rest.
On the business property taxes, what's the split between local and the state in terms of percentage? How much of that 42% is local property taxes? 90%, 80%?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I can't answer it right away, but I can point you to where the answer is. That might be helpful. If you look on page 27 in the study itself, you'll see a table that lists all the taxes that are included in the study, and you'll see that on the left-hand side, the first column shows the total dollars. The state property tax is about the middle of the page, $656 million of state property tax. Page 27, first column. In 2006, about $656 million was state property tax, and about $5.65 billion was local. So the property tax is still primarily a local tax, although if you look at the business portion of it, a higher fraction of that is state than off the total, obviously, because the state taxes, except for cabins, is only on the business property. Similar numbers for 2011, by the way, are shown in the next chapter after that. But it's a good table, actually, to call your attention to as committee members, because it really summarizes a lot of information about the taxes, and you can see the dollar amounts and things there. Business taxes make up about a third of all the taxes collected in the state. Total business taxes, 32.5%. The other two-thirds of taxes are taxes on individuals, and the largest of those, of course, is the individual income tax. But homeowner taxes would come in far second from that, and the sales tax on consumer purchases also is very large. You will notice we include, we do assume the working family credit is a negative income tax, and we do assume the property tax refunds are negative property taxes, so they're in here as taxes, but negative taxes, and it's important to realize that explains some of the results as well. In terms of business taxes, I really, to explain how we do the allocation, there's a careful explanation in Appendix B of the study, but I just want to say we do include the business taxes in the study. It's not like we define them and then put them aside. They may be shifted forward to consumers at higher prices. They may be shifted back to employers, to employees rather, in lower wages or benefits. And we use economic logic, sort of economic models, to try to estimate what we think is an appropriate apportionment of those taxes. The potential for shifting depends on how high Minnesota's taxes are relative to those in other states, and also depends upon whether the market is local or national. If you think of a property tax on a grocery store, you're competing with other grocery stores, they're all paying the Minnesota property tax, so all your competitors have that cost. But if you're a manufacturer in Minnesota, the property tax on you, Minnesota property tax, you can't raise your price because your competitors aren't. You're selling in a national market. So you'll have a different result, and we try to go through and make the distinctions we can between types between industries, and we do compare to other states to do this. Again, it's a fairly complex theoretical basis. It's sort of consistent with a model where capital flows easily across borders, and it's sort of an open economy model of taxation. If owners do bear the burden, some of that burden will be borne by non-residents. If we say that the burden on a corporation is borne by stockholders or borne by the owners, a lot of the stockholders who own shares in companies doing business in Minnesota actually reside in other states. So to the extent that the burden is borne by the stockholders, quite a bit of that may be exported, in our sort of terminology, exported to other states. The incident study, we start by building a careful database of about 105,000 households.
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Wilson, on the exporting of the tax, and we've got back that, there's about $3 billion exported. Some of that would be the corporate tax. Do you have a feel for what the ratio is between the property tax that exported by people who own property in Minnesota who reside elsewhere and the business that's exported? Is that do you have any feel for that?
Chair, Senator Scoey, again, on page 27, you will see some export numbers there. It varies by tax. On page 27, the exported number is the third column from the right. And if you compare that to the number all the way, either to the business share or to the number all the way to the left, you can sort of get a feel for the percentage that's exported. Clearly, there are some taxes we assume there are a number of cabins, for example, owned by non-residents, so we take that into account. Non-residents pay some individual income tax as well, so some of that sales tax, some is purchased, some is on purchases by non-residents who are visiting the state. And then for the business taxes, a portion of that is exported that way. And you get a feel for the shares in there.
Thank you.
Dr. Wilson, slide 4, the taxes on individuals. It seems like we skipped that. Want to talk about that, or are you coming back to it? Question is kind of looking at it. Where does the health impact fee figure into that? As long as that most recent 75-cent tax we put on cigarettes wasn't a tax, is it not factored into this at all? I mean, it's a significant amount of money.
It certainly is a significant amount of money, Mr. Chair. The health impact fee on cigarettes and tobacco is not included in the study. However, on page 64 of the study, you will see all the information you need if you want to add it to the results. This is obviously a sensitive issue. I won't say that it's defined as a fee by the legislature in the way the wording is done. But on page 64, you'll see that, in fact, it is a very regressive tax, and you can see the impact of adding that to the if you sort of put that on top of the tax study and say, what have we included in the study, you would see a significant impact on the regressivity of the overall system. So we've tried to provide you with the information you'd need if you think it should be in the study, but it is not in the study itself. in the results that are presented elsewhere.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Dr. Wilson, could you provide us with a pro forma page that did act as if it were included? Based on your information on page 64?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, we could certainly do that. I think we would.
Dr. Wilson,
we could just simply include.
Mr. Chairman, I think we need to see the
whole
picture.
Just add it to the cigarette tobacco tax on the other sheet, and it would just flow through and show the numbers.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Wilson, I appreciate the constraints of the statutory language, but the economic impact, I would like to see it included as if it were part of that cigarette and tobacco taxes, and I'm just fine if you put an asterisk there.
Dr. Wilson, are there any other fees that should be included, or that you highlighted in the report that are maybe outside of the statutory definition of what should be included?
Mr. Chair, the only fees that are in the report, I mean, there are a few things that are labeled as fees in some sense in the report. The minimum fees on corporations, for example, and partnerships and S-corps, those are in the report. They have been traditionally. Mm-hmm. That's considered part of the corporate tax in everything, in all the work we do, and we'd actually have a lot of trouble taking it out of the mm-hmm. calculations. So that's always been in the study, even though in some technical sense. The thing is, it's in the tax chapter. It's always been considered part of the tax by people who look at it. I think we also include the I think there's a non-cigarette manufacturers who do not participate in the settlement. I think there's a very small fee on them, and I think that number may be in the totals, too. But that's based upon them being in past years, and it's very small amounts in either case. In terms of other fees that ought to be in, I can't think of others that are as similar to a tax as the ones that have been mentioned.
So. Senator Dibble.
Thank you. I see the vehicle registration tax. Is that the ongoing license tab that we often refer to as fee, or is that the initial registration that's collected?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that's the tab fee, basically. But it's right. referred to as tab fee, but it is a tax officially in
great.
The legislature. Great. Great.
Thank you.
But that's the tax. That, of course, did change quite a bit in the last legislation. We'll talk a bit about mm-hmm. that later.
Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Wilson, could you give me an example of a gambling tax? Is it pull tabs or something along those lines?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sundrum, that's correct. It's the pull tabs, bingo, et cetera.
Okay.
It's lawful gambling would be the term. It's not the state lottery, and it's not obviously not the casino gambling in the state.
What about the racetrack?
Interest.
Are there taxes on racing? Or just income taxes on racing winnings, gambling winnings at the card clubs and the racetracks?
Sure. Senator, I believe there's a small amount of tax on the horse racing as well. I don't believe there's any tax on the card clubs.
Right.
Hmm. Again, the slide on individual taxes just shows the long list of them. I think you're right. I probably should have said something about the gambling tax because it's hard to know what that is. But the others, I think, are fairly well understood. I do notice the Medicare tax. We assume that is a tax on individuals. We basically assume it raises prices of medical insurance or medical care. The incident study is built on by getting detailed information on income for 105,000 households, which then represent the 2.45 million households in the state. We do hard matches, sort of real data for income, for the income tax, homeowner taxes, the property tax refund, and the motor vehicle registration tax. For the first time, we have actual sort of hard match the data. So it's real data rather than sort of a statistical estimate. The other taxes we do have to estimate, the sales tax distribution, the distribution of taxes, mostly consumption taxes, we estimate using detailed statistical work on the Consumer Expenditure Survey, which is a national survey of expenditures, and we use their detailed analysis. So, but a lot of these are estimated, and so some of this is very hard match data. We don't do any imputation of income, so the incomes that are in there are sort of real incomes, but some of the taxes are obviously estimated. In most of our work, we divide the population into 10 groups or deciles, each with a tenth of the number of households, 245,000 households in each decile. And the lowest decile, the first decile, is the sort of the lowest income 10% of the households, and the top decile, the 10th decile, is the highest income 10% of households. And again, you'll see where those start. Again, the somewhat surprising to people that the top decile starts at only 123,000, 124,000. And we'll say a little bit more about that on the next slide, I believe.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Wilson, when you use the bottom category, when you divide it into deciles, are those incomes, is that gross income or that's taxable income, the 9,700 and the 123,900?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, that is gross income, that is total income. It does seem low, and I'll talk about why it seems low in a minute, and you may want to follow up with a question at that point, too. How do we define income? We define income to include all money income, and there's more information on pages 86 to 89 of the study. We start with federal gross income off the tax return. We don't start with federal adjusted gross income anymore because the federal government has added so many adjustments that are not really adjustments to income, but they're really a way to give tax relief to people. So we actually have gone up and started with federal gross income instead. So, for example, the tuition, in 2006 it was a tuition, and will be a tuition subtraction. But we don't think that's an adjustment to the definition of income. That is perhaps appropriate for tax policy to give a tax break, but we don't want to take that out of income. So we start with federal gross income, which is sort of wages and salaries and capital gains and the things at the top of the tax form. We add to that non-taxable Social Security and pension income, non-taxable interest income, workers' comp cash payments, welfare, including MFIP, but also general assistance and some other categories of cash public assistance. We include voluntary contributions to deferred compensation. Again, this is a change this year. We picked up a little bit more information because we're able to do that. Statute tells us to use the broadest definition of income that we can get good data on, so that has been changing a little bit through time, but that has been added. Think about it as everything, all the income you think of as cash income, with a few exceptions, but it's a very broad definition of income. It does not include, though, in-kind assistance such as food stamps or Section 8 housing subsidies. It does not or medical assistance. It does not include most fringe benefits either, and that's just lack of information. We can't find the information. We'd have to estimate it, and so we don't have fringe benefits in. And we also don't include pre-tax payments for health insurance or medical care. Anything that's paid pre-tax, we basically don't have any information on. But other than those things, we have a fairly complete income. The only other things that are really missing in the definition, we don't have child support payments. Even though they sometimes would fit in the definition. But child support payments, we cannot get that data. And veterans' pensions, we can't get that data either to try to match into this. So very broad definition of income, and we do pick up income for non-filers. If you don't file an income tax return and don't file a property tax refund return, we do go and try to calculate, get all the income information we can. So it's as complete a measure of income as we can get for the population.
So Dr. Wilson, unemployment?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do include unemployment compensation. It's taxable, so a lot of it's on the tax returns. To the extent that it's not on tax returns, we do pick that up for our sample as well.
Senator Dibble.
So just going back to the income that you don't include, for all three of these bullet points, it's difficult to get the information for all three, including the food stamps, housing assistance, medical assistance.
Mr. Chair.
On individuals.
Senator Dibble, I think we... The only one that we probably could pick up would be food stamps. That would be fairly easy, I think, to include. Housing assistance would be very difficult to get that information. We've actually looked into that, and we have a difficult time. I'm not sure what you'd do with medical assistance, but I'm not sure how we'd even measure it. Food stamps would be the easier one to bring in. And again, you can make arguments both ways, but food stamps are a little bit more like cash than they used to be. In terms of how they operate. But they're not in here in this study.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Wilson, I'm looking at page 74 in the document where those income deciles are spelled out. I know that you do it by income decile and not by population decile. However, I'm trying to figure out where the comparable number would be for those 245,000 households. What is the, not type of filer, what would be the, what is the income level of the top 24,500?
Share,
by household, not by.
By, for households.
Not by income.
Yeah. I think if, again, it's.
Where is that number?
The best place to look for that would probably be on page 29. Find it some other places too, but page 29 may be the easiest place to find the breakdowns. And the top 1%, because again, it's table 2-2 on page 29. And by the way, that if you turn the page over, you'll see the effective tax rates on page 31, but this is the dollars here. But if you look at the income ranges on the left hand side, you'll see the top 1%, and that would represent about 25,000 families, households mm-hmm. rather. And it's about $448,000 would be the break. So top 5%
so the top, the top 5% of the households, their income, gross income, is $175,000. I mean, are reading that correct?
Senator Rest, that's correct.
And which is, again, that $50,000 more than just looking at income deciles. And it seems to me that we need to keep both of those in mind and not just talk about, well, the top tenth of the income is what some of us would consider fairly reasonable middle income, maybe a little bit high on the middle income, but middle income. But then when you get to talking about people whose household gross income is $175,000, that's considerably, I think, we operate with a different mindset, and I know that the tax incidence study has wanted to deal with income deciles. We've asked for the household deciles, and I'm really pleased that we have such detailed information when you get into the weeds in the back of the document, where it does look at the type of filer for that information. But I think we need to look at both.
Dr. Wilson, as long as we're looking at page 74.
74?
Refresh my memory. At what income level married does the third tier of the income tax kick in?
It's like 112, I think.
112,
120?
Service, I think that's right, but of course that's taxable income, so you'd have to add to that the exemptions and
standard Chairman,
deduction at least.
Don't you add maybe at that level, I mean, if they're bringing it over, there's like maybe $12,000 more in exemptions, maybe $10,000 to $15,000. At that level, maybe even $20,000 in interest, taxes paid, charitable contributions. So maybe add another $30,000 on to gross income.
So, Senator Rest, your point is that nobody really gets into the third tier until they're making $130,000 to $140,000. So it's what
absolutely
the third tier. We're really talking about maybe 8% of the population,
and that's
like that.
More than this highest decile
right.
at this point.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's something less than 10% of the population, or even
in
the third
deciles,
tier.
Maybe it's not quite there. I mean, there you would get into it before that. But yep, it's just interesting.
So why do we keep talking about a fourth tier? Why don't we just talk about raising the third tier if we're really talking about 8% of the people?
Because it would be interesting. The response to that, it would be interesting to know how that would have an impact on that relationship between the percentage of their income that they pay in taxes and state and local taxes and the and the middle tiers, which I believe the report shows that the middle tiers are going, are increasing their percentage of their income that's paid for state and local taxes, and that top tier is showing a reduction. And I think the information would be valuable to tell us whether you want to either lower the amount at which you start charging 785 or skip the 785 rate completely and insert some higher rate.
Dr. Wilson, that at the beginning of the 10th decile, what is their net effective tax rate overall? Is it down from 12.3 down to about 10? I mean, has it turned down by then? I bet you have a chart on that.
Yeah. It probably turns down slightly after that point in a serious way, but it's around that point that it would start to turn down. I would say also that because we have a mix of households in here, when you talk about the percentage of all households, some of these are not filing an income tax return. So if you do a HITS run, you're going to get a higher percentage affected than when you include the non-filer population. And, of course, for a married couple, you'll have more than 8% in that top because their incomes tend to be higher, and this is the entire population, including singles and others. So in terms of percentages, just it's a little hard to go to look at this and talk about percentages paying the top bracket just because we're mixing households together here.
Because we're mixing single filers and head of household filers with married joint.
With married couples.
Senator,
we do have some tables in the back in Chapter 5 that actually would give you, that actually give you deciles just for married couples with kids, for example. So you can look at where the average is for those and what taxes are paid in some detail for just married couples with kids or just married couples without kids or just seniors or just single parents. So we do try to give you some more where we basically say, what if that were the whole population, divide that into deciles, and you can get more detailed information by looking at those tables.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Wilson, and maybe members. The part of the chart on page or graph on page 29 that I find the most interesting is the household income per decile total. And the looks to me like, and maybe Dr. Wilson, you can correct me if I'm not reading this right, but $71 billion of the $165 billion total is in the top decile, but then if you go to the top 5%, which would be about 40% of the total, and then the top 5% has about 30% of all the income, and I think that might be one of the reasons you consider a fourth tier is because mm-hmm. of that movement that's in that that you see there on that line.
The challenge, Senator Skoy, is the majority leader in the Finance chairman have given me a task to raise $2 billion in this committee, and it's you can't get there with a fourth tier. You just can't raise it high enough. So this committee is going to have to consider something in addition to a fourth tier unless we look at some modification of what we in the past few years have moved out of here. Senator Marty, any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman,
third tier, Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, the higher third tier would hit, what is it, 8%? I mean, it's about that, but you might need a little higher bump on a fourth tier, too.
Dr. Wilson.
Just a quick comment on our definition of household, because this leads to quite a bit of confusion. If you compare our study with the census, and people have done this, and it looks like we've done something wrong, okay? We have 2.45 million households with a median income of about $40,000. The census for the same year shows 2.05 million households, which means we've got about 20% too many households, and their median income is quite a bit higher. They have 2.46 persons on average per household. We have a much smaller household. So the question is why, and the answer is that they're both right, okay, and that we are, in fact, consistent with the census. We define a household in here to be defined as basically an income tax filing unit. It's the taxpayer, the spouse, any dependents, and we throw the dependent income in with the household as well. The census, of course, just says anybody who lives in the same housing unit. So four singles living together would be one housing unit, one household for the census, but four for us. Unmarried couple living together would be two households for census for us, but one for the census. So that explains the difference. It also explains why our incomes look so low compared to census, is because we just have a lot more single-person households out there than the census would. So it's just good to keep in mind. Our numbers are, our population actually matches the census almost perfectly, except we do not include part-year residents, and that explains about 50 or 60,000 difference in our total population. This is what I should have probably started with, but this is the picture, okay? These are the results for 2006. Again, what you find is the same pattern to some extent as in past years. You find that the drop-off in the 10th decile, those over $124,000. And for the top five and the top one, again, the top five and top one are included in the top 10, and the top one is included in the top five, so that's why the break there is put in there. But this is the pattern you see. A couple of cautions. I think you do want to be wary of the first decile, and you've been around, you've heard this before quite often, but first decile really is a measurement problem more than anything else. 23.8%. I can move back to this graph if we need to, but effective tax rate of 23.8% is far higher than other deciles. We think the tax burden is overestimated for several reasons. Some people have temporarily low income. You have business losses that throw you down into negative incomes. Well, if you have negative incomes, I don't even know how you define an effective tax rate. If you have zero income, I said once that it was an infinite effective tax rate. I was corrected by a mathematician who said it's undefined. But if you divide, effective tax rate is just total tax divided by income. You divide by a zero, it's basically undefined. So we do have some difficulties in the first decile. We also think income is understated. In our sample, we don't get all the income for some of these people. These are primarily single people. A lot of them we have no information except what we can pick up from like W-2s or something. We don't include in-kind income. I wouldn't say that's a reason why our tax burden is overestimated, but it does explain the tax burden being so high. We define income that way, so I wouldn't say it's a mismeasurement, but it does explain if you're in a Section 8 housing and you're getting food stamps, your total consumption may be quite a bit higher than it looks like it would be possible without those. I would also be amiss if I didn't say we also have some uncertainty at the very top. We know what the incomes are pretty well at the top. We know what the homeowner property taxes are. We know what the income tax is. But sales tax and some of the other taxes, we have a hard time estimating. The consumer expenditure survey that we use to estimate the consumption taxes doesn't have a lot of millionaires. Not many millionaires take the five different survey and to keep a diary of what they spend for the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So we really are sort of pointing. You know, you do our work and then you sort of point out and say, well, we think it's going this way. In particular, with the income deciles, we actually show totals for 24 households at the top, and at least the consumption taxes, we're a little wary of those. So I'd also be a little careful at the very top. I'm not so much concerned with the top decile or even the top five. At the top 1% or in the income deciles, as we'll get to, there's some question there of exactly how accurate we can be. We've got the best estimate we can come up with, but a couple perspectives in terms of spend. Just realize we're saying here that the top decile pays a smaller percentage of its income in tax than any other decile. Okay, if you look at the figure, that's what it's showing. But of course, people can respond to that in different ways. You can say, well, but they're paying an awful lot of tax. They're paying 37% of the state and local tax burden. The top 10% pays 37% of the tax burden. They pay 54% of the income tax, 29% of the consumer sales tax, 27% of the homeowner property taxes. In other words, we could present the results in that way instead. We do it with effective tax rates. We think it is appropriate way to do it. But you can interpret it different ways. You can look at things different ways. I think the comment from Senator Scoe, I believe, that the income that the top decile has, the reason their effective tax rate's lower is because they have 37% of the total burden, but they have 42% of total income. So their burden is less. It's a smaller share than their share of income, which is why that drops off in the top decile. Also a comment, we're not including federal taxes here. We're not quite sure how to put them on top, even if we wanted to, but this is just state and local. We're looking at who pays Minnesota taxes. It's a fairly narrow question. Some have asked, well, what if you put federal taxes on top of that? And we don't have a real answer for that. There are some methodological issues in how you combine our methodology with something else there. And the question, aren't we still doing about in other states? We'll look at that in a little while, but that question comes up, and there, we do have some information in the report about how we look compared to some other states. Let's pay just a quick moment on some definitions, progressive, regressive, progressive and regressive, and the Suits Index, just to get a feel for these numbers, because they are used so much, the terms are used. If we had a diagram where we have the effective tax rate is just tax divided by income, if every decile had the same effective tax rate of 11.2%, we would have a horizontal line when we graphed it. Okay, that's a proportional tax because everyone is paying tax in proportion to their income. The people at the top are paying more tax. If your income is twice as great, you're paying twice as much in tax. If your income is 10 times as great, you're paying 10 times as much in tax. But you're paying the same percentage of income throughout the distribution. The Suits Index for that, what we use is our overall measure, sort of a summary measure of the Suits Index. Statistical measure of regressivity or progressivity would be zero. So this is sort of proportional tax. If you then look at an upward sloping line where the tax rate is actually going up as your income goes up, this is a progressive tax by the technical definition. In this case, the tax would start at a little less than 10%, go up to a little less than 12%. That upward sloping line would be a progressive tax. Higher income people pay a higher percentage of their income in tax, but the Suits Index, notice, isn't much different, 0.02. I want to point out how a small change in the Suits Index really represents a quite significant change in the tax structure. If you have a downward sloping tax, that's the same Suits Index, except it's negative because it's regressive. So a negative Suits means regressivity. And again, a small change. If we look at more regressive yet, I think the slide you have has all these on it. The more regressive, notice that looks quite a bit steeper. It looks quite a bit more regressive than the pink line, and yet the Suits only goes up from minus 0.02 to minus 0.06. So small changes in that Suits Index can represent fairly large changes in the distribution of the tax burden. And we'll see later on that when we're looking at changes in the Suits through time in Minnesota, they're not changing by a lot in terms of the number, but a small change can be quite significant. Again, the term regressive here is a technical term. All it means is a downward sloping line. All it means is the higher your income goes, the lower the percent of your income you pay in tax. It has a pejorative sound to it, but it's a technical term rather than a political term.
So, Dr. Wilson, could we plot Minnesota's Suits Index on this line?
Mr. Chair, you're way ahead of me here. On this slide, if you look at the next slide, yeah, okay. You'll see Minnesota's line plotted. And I put the pink line on there because the pink line has the same average effective tax rate and the same Suits Index as what Minnesota's distribution does. So basically, despite being somewhat progressive between the third and fifth decile, where it's upward sloping, and dropping in the 10th decile, we have the same Suits Index. Think about it as being sort of like the same measure of regressivity as the pink line, the downward sloping line. I would make one other comment. The first decile, we did sort of say, well, what would happen if we throw those people out? What if we just didn't count them? If you throw them out, our Suits Index, instead of being minus 0.053, would be minus 0.044. Still regressive. The first decile is not where the action is in terms of the Suits Index. It's the 10th decile. If you throw that out, the Suits Index falls down to minus 0.02. So the regressivity is more coming from the top decile than from the first. And so it's not just a creation of that first decile measurement issue. Again, just to get a feel for what Suits Index means, I think when we look at some numbers later on, this is useful. If we build our tax up by pieces, I think it also helps understand why our system looks the way it does. You have one, I think it's all built together, but this is the income tax. And the income tax is the progressive tax in the system. The income tax starts with a negative tax rate in the first two deciles. Those are the refundable income tax credits, working family credit, dependent care, K-12 credit. Negative tax rate, almost zero in the third decile. And then it rises. It rises to 5.4% in the 10th and 6% for the top 1%. Now, you may ask, well, wait a minute. I thought we had a 7.85% tax rate. How can the top 1% be only at 6%? But remember, we have non-taxable income in our definition of income here as well. And, of course, you don't pay 7.85% on all of your income. You only pay it on the part of your income above that top tier. But the income tax has a Suits Index of plus 0.194. It's very progressive, and it represents 36% of the tax burden in Minnesota. If you then add on to that property taxes, you can see that the residential property tax after property tax refund actually doesn't look all that regressive. Again, if you look at the third decile, between the third decile and about the eighth decile, the height of that, the effective tax rate, the residential property tax as a percent of income is almost the same throughout the middle range. It does drop quite a bit at the top. In the eighth decile, rather than decile 5 through 7, it's 2.6 to 2.7% would be the height of that. It drops to 1.3% in the 10th and drops further in the top 1 and top 5 and top 1. Residential property tax is regressive after PTR, but the Suits Index of minus 0.148 is not nearly as regressive as some of the other taxes.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Wilson, I know that it's not part of this, but is there any way that it would be useful for us to think of this tax incidence by tax type to be able to at least intuitively think about the value of local government aid and the market value credit on residential property and how I know it doesn't come into this thing, but how we could intelligently talk about the way in which local government aid and the market value credit decreases property taxes. In addition to the PTR or the renter's credit is in here too, right?
I mean, certainly the effect of those are in here, but you're right. We don't have them broken out. In some ways, we could do a little bit of that. We actually have the market value credit,
right.
I believe, in
because
our database.
Because that does go to the individual.
You could actually take it out from the individual records and see what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
The local government aid is a little tougher because you'd have to make assumptions. I'm hoping when the VOS database is complete that some of those questions will be answered there, and we can feed that information to some extent back into our incidence database as well.
And Mr. Chairman, the reason asking that question is when I heard today that the impact of the governor's proposals over the next 3 years is like an increase of $600 million in property taxes. And so if that's coming about because of the cuts being proposed in LGA and market value credit, then it seems like to me we need to kind of take that information in when we're looking at the property tax relief that's given to individuals based on the amount of their tax and their income through the PTR and the renter's credit. And it's hard to I wish there were something intuitively we could – I mean, it ought to change that line, but I don't know how to do it, just kind of anecdotally put a number on it. Just think it would be interesting when we have the discussion about the impact of state policy on local government taxing ability.
So Dr. Wilson, if we didn't have the property tax refund program, where would the Suits Index on the residential property tax be compared to the sales tax then?
I'll go ahead and put the sales tax on here because you can see it's more regressive. You have that on your slide already, but this is a sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you put all other taxes on top, you'll see they're even more regressive on average. The residential property tax, sort of the white part on that graph, the Suits Index for that would be minus 0.210. It would be more regressive than the sales tax if you didn't have the property tax refund programs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually a slide later, and in the book in Chapter 4, they actually have a graph that shows you the effect of that on the residential property taxes, so sort of illustrates how important those are.
So then it is accurate to say that the property tax, the residential property tax, is regressive and more regressive than the sales tax?
Mr. Chair, you certainly, I mean, remember we have the business property tax too here, or the non-residential property tax rather, which is the blue line here. It's even more regressive by our estimates. But even the homeowner tax, even the residential property tax, yes, would be regressive. Each piece without the PTR, it certainly is regressive, and even with the PTR, it's still regressive. So if you're thinking about shifting tax burdens between local government and the mm-hmm. state, and it's income tax versus property tax, you are looking at an income tax that's progressive and a property tax that is regressive, no matter how much you adjust it for the PTR. Again, you can sort of see if we didn't have the income tax, this would be, you would never get a system that was at all near proportional All the other taxes, the income tax has to sort of undo what all the income tax and maybe the PTR has to undo what all the other taxes are doing in terms of progressively to get us close to a proportional system. For individual taxes, just a couple of comments. The only progressive tax is the individual income tax. The estate tax is also progressive, and the industrial property taxes turn out to be progressive too. I would comment that the reason the industrial property taxes are progressive is because the manufacturing has a very hard time raising prices on customers just because their taxes go up because they're competing in a national market, and these are Minnesota-specific taxes. It's precisely because of the competitive problems of manufacturing as a result that most of that tax is borne by the owners. So it makes it, it's progressive because the tax burden is borne mostly by the owners of the property rather than by consumers. But, of course, that's part of the problem with the industrial property tax as well. Industrial property tax is a fairly small tax relative to other property tax, but do notice it turns out to be progressive in our estimates. But, again, a high percentage exported of that tax as well.
Senator Dibble.
I wanted to ask about the PTR if you're here. Okay. So rental property taxes before PTR, are we able to, with some precision, understand where PTR, or if we're trying to calculate, because there's a lot of attention to PTR over the past couple of years. Are we giving, is it in sync with what renters are actually paying for their property taxes, et cetera? At what point does PTR help you turn the curve or turn the slope and make it progressive? Are we able to know with some precision the level of refund that brings property taxes paid by renters from regressivity to progressivity? So, you know, because we have a lot of debate about the 19%, whether that's the right number, how far down should it go, et cetera. There's a proposal, of course, in the governor's budget to scale it back significantly. We've entertained those ideas here previously.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, if you look at the end, you do slide 40, I think it's numbered 48 on here, or 46, the top of the last page on your handout, does show the impact of the PTR, but it's showing it for both homeowners and renters together, so it's not just the renter piece. Rental property tax, there have been significant reductions in rental property taxes over time. And yet the 19% was never adjusted downward after that. So I think there is a general belief that the 19% represents a higher percentage than you would if you were going in trying to estimate the percent that is more typical. And I think there is a Department of Revenue study that tried to do that a couple years ago. For purposes of the incident study, clearly what matters is just how big the refunds are. I mean, if it's not offsetting renter property taxes, it's offsetting the regressivity somewhere else in the system. So we don't, there's nowhere in the study you're going to find sort of that kind of a comparison that you're asking about, really. Most progressive taxes in the system are cigarettes and gambling, followed by rental property taxes before PTR. The solid waste tax, motor vehicle registration tax, in its 2006 form before the caps were taken off or grandfathered off, those caps made that tax more regressive, because more expensive cars are being taxed at a lower rate. And the depreciation schedule also was tilted to raise taxes on less expensive cars. Farm property tax, MnCare provider taxes, and motor fuels excise taxes, sort of in order of regressivity. Again, on that page 27, you can see a suits index to the right-hand side of the column for each tax and get a feel for which are more regressive from there. An alternative presentation are income deciles. I think there are some people in this group who like income deciles more than population deciles. And there are, I just want to make a couple comments about the income deciles. They're shown in the beginning of Chapter 4. The results are shown for income deciles. This is a case of how you slice the pizza. When my son and I, when I used to make homemade pizza with my son, he liked pepperoni a lot. I like pepperoni a lot. But he would manage to get all the pepperoni on sort of one side of the pizza, and then when he cut the pieces, he would get all those pieces. I thought it might be best to slice the pizzas, so there was the same amount of pepperoni on each slice rather than the same amount of crust. And it's sort of the same thing here. You were slicing the pizza differently to get the same income in each decile instead of the same number of households. So all we're doing is cutting it. We're just slicing it differently. There's nothing wrong with either one. Both of them are correct. If you look at the population deciles and the income deciles in this diagram, you'll see that when you look at income deciles and you put 10% of the income in the first decile, you got to get 41% of the households in there to account for 10% of the income. So your first income decile includes more than four population deciles. You're losing a lot of detail at the bottom. On the other hand, the top population decile, the one that starts at $124,000, you divide that up into four deciles with income deciles, you get a lot more detail at the top. So the question is, do you want more detail at the top or more detail at the bottom? You can use both of these in various ways. They give you different income breaks. They're both reasonable ways to divide the pie. The diagram looks a lot different. There's no first decile problem. When you got four deciles together, that first decile problem disappears. It just gets averages away. You also get a downward slope that just sort of is more continuous here, showing the regressivity. So you get a different picture. I would, again, tell you the top 24 households here, we don't really have a good feel. I don't know that 7.4% number, since a lot of it is due to the sales tax going down so much at the top. But still, this is a different way of looking at the distribution. Your 10th population decile has an average of 10, but that's divided into four groups here. And so to some extent, Mr. Chair, when you said where does it start turning downward, if you look at this, you'd say it starts turning downward almost from the beginning. I mean, it's not quite as precise a downward, a switch in the slope, although I guess you'd say between the 8th and the 9th is where the biggest drop would occur. Anyway, that data is shown at the beginning of Chapter 4. If you like income deciles better, you could find the data presented in that way. It gives you more detail at the top of the income distribution. So look a little bit at history. What happened between 06 and 04 and 06, and what will happen going into 11? The first thing we look at in here, and there's not much action here, is the effective tax rate. What's the overall effective tax rate for all Minnesotans? What's the average share of their income they pay in state and local taxes? The number in 2006 is 11.2%. That's down from 11.6% in 2004. If you look at the history, we were a lot higher than that in the 90s. We topped out in 1994 at 13%. Have dropped a lot by 2000, and have been fairly steady since then. The footnote notes that we did change our definition of income. We brought in some more income sources. If we hadn't changed the definition of income, it would be 11.4% and 11.6 and 11. So for historical comparison, it's really not dropping as much as this suggests. But it certainly is staying down at the same levels it's been basically since 2000 or close to there. Again, not much going on there, but if we look at the Suits indexes, we look at the regressivity, you see a lot going on. This is the history of the Suits index. Again, always negative. But in the early years, it was pretty close to minus 0.01 or minus 0.02. It didn't get below minus 0.02 until 1998, when it jumped to minus 0.04. As recently as 2002, it was under minus 0.02, or above, I guess. I guess it's above minus 0.02, a negative number. In 2004, it was minus 0.024. And this year, it's minus 0.053, which is the largest drop, the sort of the lowest the Suits index has been since we've been doing this. And I would make a note here on your slide, because I forgot to put this in later when I want to talk about 2011. But in 2011, it's minus 0.051. It doesn't go back down again in 11. 11, it's minus 0.051. It goes down a tiny bit, but stays about where it is in 2006. And the question is why? What's going on? What's the big change between 04 and 06 that could explain this? We've often puzzled about this when we've done these studies. I remember in 1998, we wondered why. What happened here? Why would this drop this way in 1998? That was not the income tax cuts. It wasn't quite clear what was going on that would bring about that big a jump. And these are big changes. Okay, this is not just a minor change. I would say that part of this change is due to methodology. We matched for the first time to the motor vehicle registration tax, the TAV fee, and we found out when we did that it was a lot more regressive than we thought it was in previous studies when we were trying to estimate it in other ways. That accounts for about 0.004 of that drop. So you're really looking at 0.025 maybe that you're trying to explain here as the drop. A couple of points on that. It's really hard to see a policy change. The one big policy change between those 2 years that you can look at is the HIF fee. But of course, it's not in here, so it can't explain it. If it was in here, you'd have a drop, by the way, to minus 0.066, so it would be a larger drop. But it's not in there. It's very hard to find a policy that can be big enough in those 2 years to do anything like this. It's not a change in the mix of taxes, although they do change. Again, the suits index has this beauty in it that it's a weighted average of the individual tax suits. So you can decompose this and say, well, what's happening? Which tax is driving this? If the mix of taxes change and you have more regressive taxes grow and the progressive taxes shrink, you'll get a change in the suits index just because the shares are growing. Okay, but that's not what's going on, because if anything, the mix of taxes is moving toward greater progressivity. If all that changed was the mix, it says here the suits change would be plus 0.003, not minus. It wouldn't be going down, it would be going towards zero. Moreover, it takes a lot to move the suits index. Okay, we're trying to explain minus 0.025, and I'm going to skip the last thing and come back to it here. But if you want to know what it takes to move the suits index, some of you saw this last year or 2 years ago. It takes a lot to move the suits index by minus 0.025. Keep in mind what you're trying to do. Try to explain minus 0.025 of change. If you raise the income tax by 10%, you'll change the suits by 0.009. That's only not even half. If you raise income tax at the top decile by $250 million, you only got 0.006. That's not anywhere near 0.025. Cut the sales tax 6% and backfill the income with higher income taxes, again, 0.008. These are big policy changes, and yet you get fairly small changes in the suits compared to what we see between 4 and 6. Cut homeowner property taxes by 20%, again, a relatively small change in the suits compared to the historical change. Increase the sales tax rate by 0.5% makes it more regressive, the system, but not that much. Again, small changes. The gas tax, small change in the suits, nothing like minus 0.025. Even the cigarette tax increase to 75 cents would only explain 0.006 drop. You'd have to eliminate the PTR and all refundable income tax credits to get anything close to what we see between 4 and 6. Okay, so it's very hard to think that this is policy that's driving this change. The last bullet on slide 26 notes one other interesting thing, which is when we look at the suits index, almost every, with one exception, every individual tax became more regressive between 4 and 6. Now, that suggests either we did something wrong, our methodology changed enough to do that, but it's hard to understand how methodology would change homeowner property taxes and income taxes in that way. It might change some consumer taxes if we did something different, but when every one goes that direction, you've got to wonder, is there something bigger going on here? Is something more explaining it? There's a slide in here that is, yeah.
Oh, I'm dying to get to the answer. I wanted to take a guess. But I think I might have jumped ahead and gotten my answer. But I'm wondering if we're getting poorer, incomes are going down.
Pardon?
I wonder if it's a function of incomes across the population.
Senator Dibble, certainly the income distribution is what we're going to look at as a possible explanation. Yeah.
Sure.
Again, we don't know quite what's driving the income distribution, so it sort of gets you a half answer, but it gets you part of the way there.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Wilson, so the property tax, not the property tax refund and so on, but the increase in property taxes, when you're looking at the change in the suits index, does that explain a chunk of it, or is that insignificant as well?
Let me look at my notes here. I think the property tax growing to some extent did explain a little bit of it, but it's offset by other things that are changing. So the growth of property tax by itself can't explain this kind of a change by itself. So again, the changes are large. This diagram is ugly, and when I see it blown up to a full page, it's really ugly. You'll notice nothing's labeled in the bottom of the diagram, but it looks like a mirror image, right? You look at those two, it's sort of a mirror image. It's like Jaws, you got teeth coming from both sides. One's a mirror image of the other. The suits index on the top, look at the years when it is most regressive. 98, 2000, 2006. Where is it least regressive? 2002, 1994, 1990. If you look back at the history and you say, what was going on? What could differentiate those years? There's something about those years that might make a difference. What's actually graphed in the bottom here is somewhat distorted, but it's the share of income of the top 1% of Minnesota households. And what you find is such a close correlation. 2 years ago, I said this correlation was minus 0.975. If you throw 06 in there, it's a little lower than that, but it's still more than 90% correlation between these two series, which suggests that the income distribution has an effect. And we can explain that. The Suits Index will change if you just change the distribution of income, and it will tend to change for all taxes when you do that. So what's going on here may be less about tax policy. I want to emphasize tax policy is very important. I'm not downplaying it, and we'll see later how important tax policy in Minnesota is. But the income distribution is probably driving what's going on here, and the next slide just shows what was being graphed in the bottom there. The share of the top 5%, 1% is at the blue there at the top, and the top, if you add the top two together, you get the share of the top 5%. You see quite substantial changes through time. This is the share based on our incident study database, okay? So I'm not using census data or something here, but I think you get the same type of results. But you find 1998 and 2000 were years of boom. We had big capital gains. We had big stock bonuses. And 2006, with the benefit of hindsight at least, was a pretty good year too. It wasn't the 2000, but it was a pretty good year. And so when I try to explain what's going on between 2004 and 2006, I don't have – it is somewhat a mystery. I don't think this explains it all. But I think the biggest explanation for that shift is that the economy has changed. I think we have to be careful trying to, when we interpret changes in the Suits Index between years. I think you can see, if you look at the graph, you might say there's a downward sloping line here, though. Maybe historically things are getting more regressive through time. I wouldn't point to a change between the 2 years as being due to policy, but maybe there is a trend line there that's due to policy. And certainly policy makes a difference, so I don't want to discount that. We'll talk a little bit later about some of those policies.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Wilson. Going back to what Senator Marty said, do you have information, a graph, or numbers to show us how the property tax refund program has been used? I mean, when did it just, it did kick in where people started using it more and more. Do you know what year that was in?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the PTR program did increase between 2004 and 2006 a bit. I mean, there was an increase. I can't point to the historical trend, but it has gone up quite a bit over in several different years, and it certainly makes a difference. I do know between, if we look at the growth between 6 and 11, about it's enough, just that growth projected between 6 and 11, which is not based on, some of it's based on law change, but a lot of it is participation, is projected to change the suits by about 0.002. So, I mean, it does have an impact. When you grow a program like the PTR. To be honest, all the property tax programs are really out of my research bailiwick now, so I'm less prepared to answer them than Eric Ouellette would be to answer those historical trends.
Dr. Wilson, considering what's happening to the investment markets in 8 and 9 and the – I don't know if it's fair to say the lack of capital gains income, but is there going to be a pretty big change in that top, say, 10%? Those are the people who probably have more money at risk in the market than the other income deciles. Are we going to see a big change there in 8 and 9?
Mr. Chair, if the hypothesis that it's the economy driving this, the distribution of income, if that's true, the next tax incentive study should see a substantial drop in the share of the top 1% and top 5%, and that should make the 2008 results look less regressive. On the other hand, there may be other things that offset that, but that would certainly be what you'd expect. Yeah. So, it's somewhat of a mystery to me, and again, I don't want to downplay policy, but I do want to warn that against looking at changes from 1 year to another year. If a lot of this is really driven by income distributional changes, which are driven, at least in the last 2 decades, when we've had a boom time, it has made income less equal. And that may not be true when you go back further in history, but over the lifetime of the incident studies, that certainly has been true. If I turn to what's happened between 2006 and 2011, our projections, a couple comments on the projections. The projection here is based upon current law. So this will not actually happen because we know that the tax system cannot, well, maybe it can, but it's likely you're going to have some changes in the tax system before 2011. So we're projecting based upon current law, But anything that will change, anything that's been put in since 2006 is in here. And we're looking at, and it's based upon a forecast. And unfortunately, this is a November forecast. This study is due before we get the February forecast. We may update it for the February forecast, depending upon how many revenue estimate requests we get. We've done that before. We probably should do that this time. I don't think the forecast change is going to make a huge difference, but it would make some difference.
Dr. Wilson, is there any... I hate to do this to you. I'm actually back to slide 7. I've just been thinking about what has, if we're looking for something that has changed, as employers have gotten away from defined benefit pension plans and moved more to 401k and individuals have moved to deferred types of compensation, we're including those kind of incomes in the tax incentives now, but we never included defined benefit pension plans, I wouldn't think, did we?
No.
So there's a big change going on in incomes that we're showing more income now, that we're moving more towards a defined contribution type pension plan away from defined benefits. Do we have any data on that? It's showing a pretty dramatic change, I would think. I mean, even our big Fortune 500 companies are working away from defined benefits.
Mr. Chair, in terms of this study, I think that trend is certainly a significant trend, and it would change how much shows up in wages. But if you do put money into a 401k or something, that in past studies that hasn't shown up either, because we didn't pick up the 401k income and other. In past studies we didn't include that because we couldn't grab a lot of it. This is the first study where we brought that in. Now, does that explain it? We actually reran the old definition of income, did the whole study with the old definition of income, and the suits didn't change. So I don't think the definition of the income is driving this, at least that definitional change. I do think that in terms of a long-term trend, you may see that having an influence. But I don't think, I mean, we actually thought that, we thought when we changed that definition, we brought some of that stuff in, we might be driving the results. So we went back and redid it, and the suits doesn't budge. So it doesn't seem to have any effect. We did change the definition in several ways, so maybe that part alone would have some effect, but the combined effect was nil. If we look at 2006 to 2011, we don't see a big change. I mean, there is a change here. It falls, the effective tax rate falls in the first three deciles. It rises in the rest. There's an effect here. The suits index becomes a little less regressive, but maybe not significantly so. It's a very small change. So what you're looking at is very little change. On the other hand, this diagram hides an awful lot that's going on. When you look at 2006 to 2011 projections, what's really going on is a major shift in the shares of taxes. If you look at state taxes, the next slide, drop by a lot. The effective tax rate for state taxes drops by a lot over that period of time. The effective tax rate, the average, goes from 8.3% to 7.9%. And the suits index for state taxes actually becomes, state taxes become a little more progressive. But it's a fairly significant drop in the state tax, in the average effective state tax rate, whereas local taxes are going up. Their share is rising from average effective tax rate is going up from 2.9 to 3.5. So while the sum total of the two shows very little change, we're seeing a significant shift from state to the local tax sector. Again, these are projections. These are projections, and you've got to remember they're based upon some assumptions about property tax growth in the future. They're based upon basically what the forecast is using for property tax growth under current law. But the local share rises from 26.7% to 31.7%. Share of the burden rises from 26.7% to 31.7% over this period of time. And that's, again, for a five-year period of time, that's a pretty big shift. If we look at this historically, the local share of total Minnesota tax burden, this is not of tax collections. This is looking at the incident studies and looking at the burden from local taxes. If you look at the history of that, you can see that we were at about 30% local, 70% state. Through the early 90s, it dropped a lot in 1998, 2000. And again, most of that's due to very rapid growth in state income taxes and state tax revenue, some cuts in property taxes when times were good. In 2002, after the property tax reform, where more state money was used to fund schools, it reached its low at 23%. And since then, it's been rising. And by 2011, the projection is that it would rise above where it was in the early 90s. So what's happening here is a fairly significant change in the shift from state to local in terms of our revenue sources. And I think that's probably the most significant thing that you see going on in our projections. The box here, which I don't think is on your printout, notes that Minnesota's local tax share was smaller than all but five of the states. We are a state that has very low local taxes relative to state taxes. We are one of the, you know, only five other states have collect a smaller share of their total taxes in local taxes. And that includes states like Hawaii, which does almost everything at the state level. But we are unusual. And, of course, we do this because of local government aid and because of other programs. We use state funds to pay for more schools than is typical. So we are an atypical system in terms of our state and local, the way state and local government, how we share responsibilities for revenue raising. This is a significant change, and it does, when you look in the text on page 21, you'll see some comments about it, but the state tax burden grows only 9.7% in those 5 years. State tax burden, again, I'm not talking about tax collections here, because all we got here is burdens, so it's the amount borne by Minnesota residents. Grows 9.7%. That's less than the income growth. That's why the effective tax rates for state taxes go down. The only way effective tax rates can go down, since they equal taxes divided by income, is that taxes go down, don't rise as fast as income goes up. So that's why it's dropping. The local tax burden grows 37.5%, 2.5 times as fast as income. So you see significant shifts there, and some of those are regressive taxes. So you see a significant increase in overall shares of regressive taxes. Property taxes are the biggest part of that. Motor fuels taxes go up because of the increase in the gas tax. MnCare taxes go up because they always go up. MnCare medical expenses rise faster than other expenditures, so they tend to go up just by themselves. Local sales taxes are going up. That's partly the 0.25% county sales taxes in the metro area. Motor vehicle registration tax goes up quite a bit because of the change in taking the caps off and changing the depreciation schedule. The combined impact of that shift, those changes, would be to drop the suits index by 0.013. We'd go from minus 0.053, we'd go down another 0.013 to minus 0.066 if this is all that happened. You know, we don't see that kind of a change, but there's a lot going on here that would seem to make the system more regressive. On the other hand, the shares of a lot of other regressive taxes are actually going down. Sales tax is growing very slowly. Corporate tax is shrinking. The cigarette tax is growing very slowly. Mortgage and deed taxes also shrink quite a bit, and that's regressive tax. That almost offsets the growth of the other regressive taxes. So we have some regressive taxes growing rapidly. We have other regressive taxes shrinking. The income tax holds its own over this period of time in terms of the projection. And so when you also look at the increased property tax refund, basically these shifts in taxes pretty much offset one another. We're almost back where we started. In addition, a number of the taxes become less regressive individually. And I think that's, again, the economy driving some of that. And that's enough to bring the tax down. I'm still surprised. I would have expected the suits index to fall by more than just 0.002. It goes from minus 0.053 to minus 0.051. That's hardly any change. Again, I know the forecast for 2011 is not real rosy, but it still seems like you'd expect a little bit of more of a change there. Income growth, though, is very slow in the projections, and that could be accounting for it.
So
a lot's going on between 06 and 11, but the suits index isn't changing much, is the bottom line.
Dr. Wilson, so if there are only five states that have a higher local tax burden, and Minnesota's sixth, is it fair then for the governor to say that local governments are out of control, that we have to have levy limits on them? He vilifies local governments an awful lot, and I mean, if we look at how our local governments compare to other states, I mean, our burden is pretty favorable, I guess, compared to other states. Is that fair to say?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I really want to ask that question, but I will say
I'm wondering why that box isn't on our chart.
It it was a last-minute addition.
Okay,
is part of the reason. Just a couple comments. When we say that, I said that our local tax share is lower than in all but five of the states. That doesn't really say where our local tax burden is relative to other states, because it's just, I'm just looking at the proportion of our total taxes that comes from local versus state. Maybe all our taxes are higher, so that the local tax might be, you know, we're not looking at tax rankings, in other words, except the local share. We're also not looking at local government expenditures. So to the extent that local governments are getting money from the state, local government expenditures, including schools, may in fact not be anywhere near as low relative to other. And I don't have a number for you there, but in some sense, if you talk about, you were more talking about the expenditure side than just the tax. All I was saying is we have a system that tends to collect the state's tax at the state level and give some of that money to local governments so they can keep their taxes lower.
Historically been where Minnesota has been at?
Mr. Chair, I think at least since the Minnesota miracle, I think that's been the case. I'm not sure if that goes back before that. But when you look at the states that have very low local tax shares, there are a number of reasons for it. One is that they just do everything at the state level. They just spend their money at the state level. Their local governments are negligible in terms of their impact for some of them. And then other states are states that have a significant share of local government aid and aids to schools. So there are two reasons why that share would be low.
Sir, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Wilson, on the local share of total Minnesota tax burden going back to 31% property or local taxes, I guess, which would primarily be property taxes, does your data recognize that the changes that were made in the property tax system so that a whole different group of people are paying that 31% as opposed to the 30% that was in 94? We went away from the gen ed levy, which was fully equalized and on a different tax. And, if we have some reductions in LGA, as Senator Ress talked about, that's on a need-based formula. Does that recognized in your suits index or in your data that there's different people paying these property taxes now than there were before?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, the short answer is yes, it is. I mean, we do look at homeowner property taxes completely separately, and we actually know what's happening to those. That we actually know what each person in the sample's homeowner property tax is. So that, to the extent that it's changing that, to the extent that taxes are shifted to different types of property, that shows up. Clearly, over time, the shares of business property tax and residential property tax have changed quite a bit, and that shows up in each incident study in the tax years. So the projections are done by, if you think about the type of property tax printout you get from staff when you look at a property tax change, and it has all the categories of property taxes, we use those same categories in allocating the burden.
Okay, thank you.
A couple other highlights in the study that I want to point out some of them have been mentioned before, but just things in the study that I hope you don't miss because all you look at are the results, the basic result picture. One thing we've tried to do is to deal a little bit more with the variation within the deciles. If you look at this chart, the top two sections are single people. You'll see the low deciles, these are population deciles again. The low deciles are almost entirely single people, either single non-elderly or single seniors. 70% of, on average, about 70% of the first four deciles are single people. If you look at the top, the bottom, the dark blue and the white and the light blue are all married, and you see the top decile is almost entirely married couples. So you've got a very different makeup of these deciles. Married couples tend to have more income on average than single people do, and we don't make any adjustment for household size or anything in these results, so we tend to have a system that puts most of the single people down toward the bottom, most of the married couples toward the top. And the question is, are we distorting things when we do that? I mean, I've always been worried that somehow or other we are really confusing things because we really are comparing, in some sense, apples and oranges here. Is the suits index being driven, in other words, by the way we're basically mixing these different categories of families together? If you look at median income, we say it's $40,000 overall, but Minnesota is a state where nobody is average, right? I mean, if you look at this, no household type has a median income anywhere near. None of them are in the fifth or sixth decile. So that when you look at the overall average, a married couple with kids has income that's well up into the eighth decile, as does a married couple without kids. A senior couple is up in the seventh decile. That's where their average is, whereas a senior single is way down in the third decile. And I love the white hair on the this is thanks to Mary Buchner, who's our that and the pizza slice, its own creativity in here, and that's due to her, not to me. So single parents, obviously, are down quite low, too. So you'll notice that there's a real difference in the distribution here. And so since no group median is near the overall median, are we really confusing things? Does combining all family types distort the study results? So in Chapter 5, partly for that reason and partly because some more detail on individual taxes, dollar amounts is useful, we have separate tables by type of household. And the example I'd give here is just a married couple with children. There are 515,500 of those households in the state, that's what we estimate. We divide that group into 10 equal groups. So we slice the married couples with kids into 10 equal deciles, population deciles. And what you find is their effective tax rates fall from 14.6% in the first to 10% in the end, 11.3. They pretty much doesn't look that much different than overall. The two index is a little bit more regressive than the overall, but not that much. You can look at those tables. I think our conclusion is it doesn't mess things up too much to put everybody together. It doesn't really confuse things in terms of regressivity measure. You will notice that married no children, is, if you look at just them, that's more regressive than any other group. Actually, single seniors is also a bit more regressive. No, senior couples is a little more regressive than average. These tables actually put all seniors together, singles and couples. If you break them apart, you get some different results. But the only surprise here really is that if our entire economy, our entire state had only single-parent families in it, we would have a progressive income tax, a progressive overall tax system, since our suit is actually positive. Again, that's the refundable credits driving that as much as anything, and the PTR, I would think. But there's some details in there. I would comment that the version that you have printed, I believe, has some errors in tables in those tables in Chapter 5. The homeowner property taxes are slightly overstated. Those have been corrected on the inline version. So if you want to use homeowner property taxes from those tables, you might want to make a note. The other lines are okay, the effective tax rates are okay, but you may want to go and take a look and look at the online version. It's not a big change, but it's one you probably should make. We treated mobile homes and farmers incorrectly in copying that average, so correcting it changes the numbers a bit. A second thing we tried to do in the study for the first time this year is to say something about how we compare to the states. And I do this mainly because a particular study was being cited by a lot of people. And I thought it's a good study, and I thought it was worth putting something in here to sort of give some feel for where we are. I do it with some trepidation because it's for a different year. It's for 2002. It's a different population. It excludes senior households, so it's not dealing with the seniors at all. It uses a different methodology, although not a whole lot different, but somewhat different methodology. It separates households into seven groups instead of into 10 deciles. The first four quintiles and the next 15% and the next four in the top one. It's somewhat similar, but. And so I've calculated what I refer to as a seven-point suit, since it uses just the 7 points rather than all 10 points to calculate the suits. A seven-point suits index in Table 4.13, which shows you in this study by ITEP, Institute for Tax... again, in their study, if I calculate suits, they don't produce the suits. They don't show the suits in their study. But if I use those 7 points to calculate suits indexes, actually, Jeff Van Wyken actually helped out with those calculations, and so I'm really using numbers that he calculated. But if we look at those, you see a couple of things. You see great variation among the states. One of the beautiful things about the federal system is we have tremendous variation across states in terms of how states decide to raise taxes. And states can have progressive or regressive systems, and they all seem to survive somehow. So the range is incredible. The most progressive state is Washington State. The seven most progressive states all have no income tax, which is what you'd expect. But you see great variation. You also find that there are 10 states that in that study had less regressive taxes than Minnesota. Minnesota is less regressive than average, but in that study at least, we don't show ourselves as being the extreme out all by ourselves in terms of the distribution. 39 states, though, are more progressive than Minnesota, so on average, we are certainly less progressive than is typical of other states.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Wilson, when you said Washington has the most progressive state, and you also commented they have no income tax, what are they doing? How do they do that without an income tax?
How do they make it so regressive, you mean?
Did you say they were the most regressive?
Most regressive.
Oh, okay.
The states that are less regressive than us in that study, interestingly enough, include some bastions of liberalism, such as South Carolina and Ohio and Montana. So Montana has no sales tax, so that's what's driving their results. They don't have a regressive sales tax. But it also has California and Vermont and Maine and Nebraska, another liberal bastion. So, but the results are interesting. I want to warn you, don't compare our 2006 suits and try to say, well, where are we now? If what we're saying is right about our regressive increasing because of the economy, that's going to affect all states, or at least most states. And so don't take our minus 0.053 inside and say, where are we now? That's not an appropriate use of this. But I think it is useful to sort of give a picture of where we are. I'm sort of hoping that ITEP redoes this study in the future. The online website is given in the footnote, so you can go and take a look at it. In terms of neighboring states, you sort of see some interesting results. So.
Dr. Wilson, where are the energy states, for example, Alaska, that have a lot of energy revenue? I mean, where are they on a scale of progressivity?
Alaska has no income tax, but it is sort of it's an outlier in other ways, too. But Alaska is always the exception.
Swearing instead of number 11, we might be 10.
16.
Well, they're not above us. Delaware is above us as well. But no, none of the energy states are above us. And Idaho is listed there. That may be a little bit about energy.
What page are we on?
We're on page 69. The other thing that is pointed out here is if you think of the regressive states as being the low tax states, there's very little correlation between the average effective tax rate in their study and the regressivity. So you can't really point to sort of low tax states being regressive and high tax states being progressive either. There seems to be very little relationship between those two. So if you look for Alaska on the right-hand side there, it's 16th on that list. And certainly you've got some other states. I think Montana is up high partly for that reason, but mostly because it has no sales tax. They have a fairly hefty income tax. Anyway, it's been some results. If you look at some of the neighboring states, you'll see that the chart here has the neighboring states, and this is in the text as well as some other ones. But interesting, South Dakota, of course, has lower taxes at all levels. They're the regressive one at the bottom, very downward, steeply downward sloping. The next one up from that is North Dakota. Again, lower taxes, more regressive than Minnesota, which is the one in the blue in their study. Iowa is somewhat like us at the bottom, but tilts down at the top. And Wisconsin is interesting because their study suggests Wisconsin has higher taxes for everybody except for the top 1%. I wanted to attest to that, but it's an interesting result from the study. Look at our surrounding states. We certainly have a lot of atypical groups around us. There's no average here you can take that makes any real sense.
So, and Wisconsin has a broader sales tax and a higher property tax. Makes them dramatically different than us?
Mr. Chair, I think their income tax also, they have a capital gains exclusion in their income tax. They also have, in terms of their rate structure, they don't give as large, like their itemized deductions are capped in different ways. And their income tax does include their property tax refund, though, so it really sort of, the homeowner property tax thing is in the income tax in Wisconsin, so it muddies the water a bit. But their income tax is also not as progressive as Minnesota's in terms of the rate structure. What keeps Minnesota's tax system less regressive than average? Again, it's no secret here, but it's worth pointing out. The income tax is a higher share of state and local tax revenue than in all but seven other states. It's not the highest, but it's relatively high. If we just changed our tax mix and cut our income tax to be down, sort of, so we get the average amount of revenue from the income tax for the nation, we'd have to cut our income tax by about 25%, raise our property taxes by about 20%, raise our sales tax by about 10%. If we did that, our suits and ducks would drop quite a bit. Partly, we dropped to minus 0.088. So part of it is we do more with our income tax. It's more important in terms of our revenue. As I said, all seven states at the very bottom, most regressive, have no income tax. If you look at our taxes, that stacking graph we looked at, you can see we couldn't possibly be anywhere near where we are if we had no income tax in terms of state. Second, our income tax is progressive. If we moved to a single tax rate, which in 2006 could have been 6.59%, we just, instead of having the 5.35, 7.05, 7.85, we just had a straight 6.59%, one single rate, our regressive would fall considerably from minus 0.053 to minus 0.071. The states that have single rate taxes, Pennsylvania, Alabama, Pennsylvania, Alabama, and Illinois are the close out the rest of the most regressive 10 in that study, and all of them have a flat single rate income tax. And finally, we have probably, if not the most generous, at least close to the most generous refundable credits and property tax refund program extended to renters as well as homeowners. So again, if you took them away, our SUS index would be considerably more regressive as well. And that's really what you point to. If you want to explain where we are, it really is more, it's more in how important the income tax is. Other taxes make a difference, but it's the share of the income tax, its progressivity, and the refundable credits. This is the diagram showing the effect of the refundable credits on the income tax. This is just the income tax. So the blue line there is the income tax with the credit, without the credits. With the credits, it's the lower line. So through decile four, you see a significant drop in the income tax burdens because of the refundable credits. And it becomes negative, paying actually negative income taxes, significant impact on the distribution of the income tax burden. And property tax refund, again, has a significant impact, dropping the effective tax rates really through the sixth decile by a noticeable amount. Without it, without the PTR, our suits index would be, instead of minus 0.144, it would be minus 0.210. It would be more regressive than the sales tax. By a considerable amount. A couple other items in Chapter 4. We already talked about the HIF. What if it were included on page 64? You can see the effects. It would drop the, make the system more regressive if we threw that into the study. Why do the population decile suits in? You got different suits indexes in this study. If you use the 10 points on the population deciles, you get one suits index. If you use the 10 points in the income deciles, you get another suits index, which is different. There's really one best suits index, and that's to use every observation in our sample, 105,000 points. George and Phil can run that on the computer very easily. It's no problem getting it, and so that's what we would actually prefer to use. But we don't have that in the historical data, and so for historical comparisons, you really have to use the population decile suits. We do report all three of them on pages 56 and 57. Again, the theoretical preference is certainly for the all-sample, full-sample suits, using every observation. What you're basically doing is you're sort of, you've got a curved line, and with 10 points, you've got straight-line segments. And when you make the full curve, you change the area under the curve. And you make, so you will get more regressive or more progressive, whatever the tax is. If it's a progressive tax, it'll look more progressive. If it's a regressive, it'll look more regressive if you go to the full sample instead. We explain that, but we still use the population suits index all the way through the report. Just for historical reasons. Unless we go back and recompute them in the historical series, we have a hard time making that switch. A very important change is also moved into Chapter 4, and on pages 65 and 66, we talk about business tax incidents. I've been troubled over the years by the use of our business tax results to explain or to try to infer what would happen to the distribution of what the burden is of a change in business taxes. If you change the corporate income tax rate, or you repeal the corporate income tax, you're going to have a different distributional effect than is shown in this study. You can't generalize from the report and say that's what would happen. And the reason is we assume all states are imposing their state and local taxes together. So the business taxes are all imposed at the same time in all states. And we compare ourselves to other states. And so part of our taxes is above the average, and that's dealt with differently than the part that's just equal to the average across the country. And so we are looking at average incidence in some sense in the study. Incremental incidence, looking at what would happen if you change the tax, gives you a very different result. And this is talked about in chapters on pages 65 and 66. My warning is just don't use the incidence results to talk about changes in business taxes. It works pretty well with the individual, with one exception. You change the individual income tax or the individual property tax, the incidence will be a little different because you should take into account the fact that federal income taxes are going to change for itemizers. We don't do that federal tax offset in this study because it doesn't mesh with our methodology of all states imposing taxes at the same time. But if Minnesota acts alone, you're going to get a situation where you ought to take the federal tax offset into account in terms of what it will do to Minnesota tax burdens. There's a diagram on that's not in your handout but is in the chapter, which for corporate tax, industrial property tax, and apartment property taxes looks at how the results are different for incremental changes in the income in these taxes rather than for average incidence as reported in the study. What basically happens is for incremental changes, less of the burden is going to be exported except for the federal tax offset. Less will be exported. More of the burden is going to fall on labor, on employees, because more is going to fall on fixed factors within the state. Less of it's going to fall on consumers, and it will change as a result the distributional effect of the change in business taxes. So we have tried to get to a point where we can do some incremental analysis and look at the effect that changes in taxes will have, business taxes will have. That takes some work, but we have done that in some cases in the past, and we're trying to get to the point where we can do that. But just a warning, our methodology on business taxes just doesn't work when you're looking for changes in the taxes instead of the existing taxes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, one question about federal tax offset, and when you talked about who pays the burden, exporting taxes. Did you say that you do count the federal offset when you're talking how much is exported, like with the individual income tax? I mean, because some of that's being shifted to 49 other states. Do you factor that in, or when you talk about exporting taxes, you're not counting that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, we do not include that in the study, and let me explain just briefly why. If we think about all states imposing their taxes simultaneously, then all states would be exporting some of their tax burden to the federal government, and the federal government can't just leave that revenue hole there. They would have to make some adjustments. So when all states are acting together, which is sort of the way we're doing this, now you can make a good case. I mean, you can make the opposite case that we should include it. I mean, but we don't include it in the study. There is a section in Chapter 4 that does look at the effect of including it if we did it for the homeowner tax and for itemized deductions, if we did it for itemized deductions for homeowner taxes and income taxes. And it makes quite a difference on the income tax on the income tax burdens. So you can make an argument for doing it. I'm not saying it's one that the case is closed. We certainly couldn't do it for business taxes. And I think the idea is that if one state acts alone, you can export that. But if all states act together, it's pretty hard for all states to export stuff to the federal government because the federal government just has to make up for it and raise the rates, and then we pay the higher federal tax rates because of the higher taxes because of the rate increase.
So, but Mr. Chairman, I understand. I think for our purposes, though, if we were to impose a tax, yeah, and we want our folks to pay as little of it as possible, the ones like individual income tax, it so much is exported, then
right,
it would make sense for us to factor that in.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, yes. The fact that federal income taxes would go down as a result of some increases in state taxes it would have a significant impact. And remember, that's why the state gave money back as a sales tax rebate at one point instead of an income tax rebate, because then there'd be none of the money would go to the feds. And so policymakers have obviously seen that impact before.
And Mr. Chairman, Dr. Wilson, one final question. The charts on page 59 on the federal offset, do you have more information on that on the website, or is it just what we have in here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, all we got really is what's in the study.
But, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Wilson, is that hard to get more information if we contact you on that? On federal offset impact on, like, by population, by income decile and so on?
I believe the way we do that is we actually estimate it in the sample, so we could break the sample into different groups and show it for different populations, yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, obviously, if you're not itemizing deductions, this would not change at all for you, so it's only the itemizers that are being affected. And so it would affect different types of households very differently.
Yeah. And Dr. Wilson, do we have less itemizers over time?
Mr. Chair, we expected to see a decline in itemizers when the federal standard deduction went up. But the federal standard deduction increases with inflation, which means it gets smaller in real terms through time. So I can't really answer. I don't know the answer to your question, but it's not a big decline certainly. And I think to some extent, it would depend upon interest rates. Mortgage interest is what drives most of the itemizers. So if interest rates change a lot, you might see a change in the itemizers.
Senator Ritz, what do you think? The number of itemizers going down?
Yes. I do believe that. And there's some benefits for not itemizing, too. I mean, there's some things that you can bring into the short form on the 1040, like contributions. You don't have to itemize to take advantage of contributions that you make. What is it, over $500 or something? You can take that on the short form. But the exemptions are pretty generous, actually, I think. And we just bring that right in, the federal exemptions.
Senator Ress, that was the House's argument to getting rid of the mortgage interest deduction is 40% of filers or itemizers or something like that was their argument.
Ask me what I think of that.
Senator Ress, what do you think of that?
Not much.
Mr. Chair, I always thought there should be a cap because it doesn't seem to me we should be subsidizing people in a $1 million house. But I wouldn't want to eliminate it because then you would really discriminate against young people. But it seemed like it should be just up to the interest on a house at a certain level, maybe $250,000 or something. Why should we subsidize luxury? It's necessity we should subsidize.
Senator Langseth, I asked the department one time if we could find a way to carve off the mortgage interest deduction for cabins, because I've always felt that probably shouldn't be deductible, but apparently we don't have a way to separate that. It seemed to me that would be a reasonable place to start with the mortgage interest deduction, is to make those second residences not eligible. But we've been having a hard time finding a way to score a number for that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure where Senator Winchesky's program, because I just read about it in the paper, where it sets the cap on mortgage interest. But it occurred to me that right now we're dealing with this horrendous mortgage foreclosure problem, and we have a lot of people who actually have fairly modest incomes who are struggling to stay in their homes. They're not being foreclosed, but they have huge mortgage interests. And I would think that, you know, keeping a high level of mortgage interest deduction may get them to be itemizers, and that we would we might be unintentionally hurting those folks by assuming that somehow because they have a lot of mortgage interest that they're rich when they're not.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rist, I wasn't at the Capitol yesterday, but the newspaper story read like she was capping it at $400 a year.
I know.
Does anybody know that?
I don't know whether she was changing it. Was she changing it from to a credit? I couldn't understand that.
I think that was what they would be able to, or the result of their deduction. I think that would come to about $100,000 house at 6% interest. and 7% income tax. I think it's the income tax that would be saved, that they were capping at 420, I believe. Yeah. And it seemed like it should be like double that or something like that. But Mr. Chairman, in
their point when we're just having a conversation. Yeah. We got to 11 o'clock.
Mr. Chairman, in Canada, they don't allow the deduction, and the result is that people live in more modest houses. And it kind of looks to me like we got ourselves in an awful lot of trouble by people living in houses that were far beyond their means, and we were subsidizing them to do that.
I think there's, I know Canada has a much different tax system than we do, because last time I bought something there is a, I think the provincial sales tax was 7% and the national sales tax was 7%. Mm-hmm. When you go buy a 2x4 at a lumberyard and pay 14% sales tax, you notice it.
We'll see.
I think, should we just announce that the Senate is unlikely to tinker with the mortgage interest deduction in our tax bill, as long as the House has already walked themselves out on the limb?
Mr. Chairman, everything is on the table. Right. I don't think we should close off anything at this point. We should really look at it, though.
I mean, I'd like to see the details, because I truly don't understand how she does it.
I just remember when Senator Pogemiller chaired this committee, Senator Marty tried to put a cap on the mortgage interest deduction, and I want to say it was like $2,000 a month or $2,500 a month, and Senator Pogemiller, I don't think we ever got it in the bill.
You would have thought the world
even
was
at that
going
kind
to
of
end.
Number.
Life as we know it in the free world was going to collapse.
And it pretty much has.
Yeah, right, and it has.
Anything else, Dr. Wilson, members?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pogemiller,
it's certainly, in terms of your job satisfaction, you must be much happier at the department than you were with the House.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, I'm very happy. The House was definitely a learning experience. I would say, Mr. Chair, if I could just add one more thing. We do have something that, if you look at the table of contents, you'll see it says coming soon, but it's just about completed, and it'll be on the online version. And I do have some sample pages here of it that if somebody wants to distribute that we could. One of the problems with I think the advantage of the tax incident study is you learn to think about the whole system together as one whole system. You don't worry so much about individual taxes being in terms of the distribution of consequences. You look at the whole system. But there is some problems, because if you want to know what the incidence of the cigarette tax is, you can't find it in the incident study. You've got a suits index, but nothing more. And so what we are putting in an Appendix C, it was online in about three studies ago. We had it at one point. But we'll have a separate page basically for each tax that does give you some information on that particular tax, sort of summary information. I know I found it useful when I was in the House to talk about the cigarette tax and motor fuels tax. This is just two examples. The cigarette and motor fuels are the two examples I've got here. But I do want to just call your attention to that. It will be in the online version. So if you do have a question about the insurance premiums tax and who bears the burden of it or anything like that for any particular tax, you can't find it in the book, but you will be able to find some information on it for 2006 at least on the website.
Boy, it sure makes it. These pages sure make a strong argument about the regressive nature of gas taxes and tobacco taxes. Wow.
I was just looking at it. Where's the tag? No, I was looking at the cigarette.
So, Dr. Wilson, there will be other pages online in addition to these two?
Mr. Chair, yes. We should have, I think that's about 30 different pages, one for each tax. We have them combined in different ways. So there's one for just all excise taxes, but then the individual excise taxes are done separately as well. So it's just an attempt to give more detail than we can put into the report itself.
And Dr. Wilson, when will those 30 pages be online?
As soon as I get an introductory page written for them, I think it should be certainly by the beginning of next week.
So, members, we'll print a copy and put it in your folder.
And Mr. Chair, as I mentioned before, the figures 5-1 to 5-5 also had an error, and you might want to print a copy of those as well. That is corrected on the version that's online right now. But figures chapter 5, those five tables have some errors in them, the way that they were printed, I believe.
Anything else, members? Dr. Wilson, very nice job. This is very helpful information for us.
It's good stuff.
Members, we are meeting next on Thursday, and we've got a number of members' bills to pick up for consideration. Please adjourn.